Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, can Pennsylvanians buy marijuana in states where it's legal? But up front, when President Abraham Lincoln died hours after he was shot by an assassin at Washington's Ford's Theater in April 1865, the president's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, screamed and was inconsolable. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton brusquely ordered her removed from the room. It's just one episode where Mary Todd Lincoln was overcome by grief. Mary Lincoln, as she was called at the time, is most often portrayed in history as unstable and possibly suffering from mental illness. But a new exhibit at President Lincoln's Cottage, a museum and historic site in Washington, suggests the First Lady may have actually been living with grief and doing so in a way that was not customary at that time. It is clear that Mary Todd Lincoln suffered greatly following the deaths of her husband and three of her four children. Today, there are thousands of American families that are grieving the loss of loved ones during the COVID pandemic. They're trying to cope and deal with their pain, just like Mary Lincoln. On today's program, we focus on grief and grieving. Joining us, Callie Hawkins is the Interim Executive Director and Director of Programming at President Lincoln's Cottage in Washington. Also, Julia Dunn, a licensed professional counselor and program director at Olivia's House, a grief and loss center for children in York. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Callie Hawkins, I want to start with you. First of all, tell us a little bit about President Lincoln's Cottage. When and why would the Lincolns visit the cottage?
Thank you, Scott. That's a great question, and thank you for having me this morning. President Lincoln first visited the cottage actually a few days after his first inauguration. We think that it's very likely that he heard about the place from President Buchanan, who had stayed out here before. And we know that he rode out on the grounds just a couple days after that inauguration. The family didn't have a local home, much in the way that other presidents who were from Virginia or who had lived nearby may have had. And so the idea that this could be a place not that far from the White House for them to retreat, I think, was really appealing to them. They made plans to come out here the first summer that Lincoln was president, and then a little something happened at Fort Sumter, and Lincoln knew that he needed to stay downtown. But by the next summer, the summer of 1862, the Civil War was raging. They had just that February before lost their young son, Willie, likely to typhoid. And I think that they were really desperate to find a place that could offer some solace and a little bit of quiet. And then we know that they spent from roughly June to November of 1862, 63 and 64 out here. So the cottage really bookends Lincoln's presidency. As I said, he came out just a few days after his first inauguration, and he was last seen riding the grounds the day before his assassination.
By the way, where in the district is the cottage? Where is it located?
That's a great question. It is up in one of the highest spots of D.C., the third highest spot in Washington. We're located on the grounds of the Armed Forces Retirement Home, which today is a retirement home for veterans, and it has a really strong continuity of purpose. It was a retirement home for veterans when Lincoln was president as well. It's located just off of North Capitol Street, sort of across North Capitol Street from Catholic University. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that the Lincolns looked at the cottage as a place for some solace. They had already lost a child before Lincoln became president, and as you mentioned, Willie died in 1862. Do we know whether the cottage was a place where the Lincolns went to mourn, where they could find some peace?
Absolutely. You know, these were mostly pastoral grounds. There were several hundred acres of mostly green space that had once been a farm, and by the time the Lincolns moved out here, was mostly park-like. And, you know, Mary Lincoln said to a friend that when we're in sorrow, quiet is very necessary to us. And she talked very lovingly about, you know, the soldier's home really providing that sense of quiet and that sense of peace that the grieving family needed.
History has not been kind to Mary Lincoln. She's often portrayed as erratic, unstable, overly emotional. I talked about that scene when President Lincoln died, that Edwin Stanton just brusquely said, get her out of here, and maybe even possibly mentally ill. Now, you're not an expert on Mary Lincoln. I understand you admit that. But you think that there could be another explanation for her behavior. What is it?
Yeah, you know, I think that even based on my own personal experience as a grieving mother, you know, I think that grief is one of the aspects that has really been overlooked. You know, and it's certainly something that she experienced just tremendous trauma in her lifetime. As you pointed out, you know, two of her sons died as little children. Her third son died at the age of 18, and her fourth child had her committed to a mental institution. And not to mention the fact that her husband was assassinated right beside her. And I just think that, you know, so much of what we know about Lincoln, especially early on, came from biographers who really chose to emphasize stories that reflected Mrs. Lincoln in a more negative light, oftentimes in order to make themselves look closer to President Lincoln. And, you know, I think that history just really has not been kind to her, in part because I think that society then and now just really has a very complicated relationship with death and with grief and with what is socially acceptable. You know, I think Mary Lincoln's grief made so many people uncomfortable. I think that that especially after President Lincoln's death, people just didn't know what to do with her. And, you know, she was prone to public outbursts. She exhibited, you know, a lot of behaviors that people would consider, you know, just were not socially acceptable. And, you know, the exhibit really isn't trying to say that she didn't have a mental illness. Maybe she did. You know, it's not trying to say that she wasn't impacted by a carriage accident that left her with a brain injury. That, you know, is probably also true. And I just think that one of the things that we really wanted to do was to say, you know, that she was also a grieving mother. And there is a reason that psychologists and scientists, you know, refer to the traumatic grief over the loss of a child as the greatest tragedy that anyone can experience. And she experienced that exponentially.
Mm-hmm. The exhibit is called Reflections on Grief and Child Loss at President Lincoln's Cottage. Now, this is not something that you often find at a historic site, and I'm sure many people have pointed that out. As you mentioned, you were grieving the loss of a child yourself, so you have a personal connection. How did that personal connection relate to the exhibit? How did the exhibit come to be?
Well, you know, we had always talked about Willie's death, especially as a sort of factor for the Lincoln family moving out to the cottage. And so this was always something that we had talked about on tours and to some degree in our permanent exhibits. But it's not something that we had explored more fully in its own special exhibit. And then in February 2018, my son was stillborn the day after Lincoln's birthday and the day after his due date. And I remember very vividly sitting at the hospital and just thinking, you know, I've worked at President Lincoln's Cottage. At that point, I had worked here for 10 years. And I just remember thinking, now I understand. You know, I had talked about this. I had shared that quote about Mary Lincoln, you know, when we're in sorrow, quiet is very necessary to us. And then in the deepest, depth of my own grief, really understood why that was so necessary. And, you know, really in an effort in many ways to integrate my grief into all parts of my life, this became something that I was more and more interested in exploring. You know, I felt a lot of pressure by society to move on, much as Mary Lincoln did. And, you know, I felt a lot of pressure from people in criticism about being sort of stuck, quote unquote, stuck in my grief. And, you know, I just recognized that this was a place that really nurtured their broken hearts, and I needed it to nurture mine. And I thought that perhaps, you know, there are other people out there for whom, you know, this might be a real connection point to the Lincoln family, to history, to an historic site. And I also recognized too that, you know, oftentimes in grief, people need a place of sort of a pilgrimage place. And that's what this place was in many ways for the Lincolns. And, you know, I think that it can be that for modern families who are grieving the loss of their children too, who might not have another sort of place to turn or to find some of that comfort.
So you actually felt a connection to Mary Lincoln when you lost your son?
I did. I felt it very deeply. You know, I think that as a mother, you know, that is the worst experience that I think that any mother can ever endure. And I think that, you know, part of what really had upset me so much about the way Mary Lincoln has been sort of remembered in history is that I look at her as a survivor. You know, I look at her as this woman that endured so incredibly much and, you know, and survived it all. And, you know, that's what I want for myself. You know, I want to know that I can survive this. And she was just that was just a real source of admiration and a real source of comfort. And, you know, I think that one of the things that can't be ignored either is that, you know, we look at, much has been talked about President Lincoln's melancholy and President Lincoln's grief and how, you know, that made him the man that he was. And we can't look at him and his presidency and his work without thinking about all of that. And, you know, then we look at Mary Lincoln and we talk about it as a weakness. And we refer to her, you know, or history has referred to her, biographers have referred to her as insane, you know, quote unquote. And, you know, I really think that it's unfair. And, I think this exhibit really can do a good job of complicating, what was a very difficult, tragic and nuanced experience that she had.
Now, this is a strange question and a very personal question, but how did you grieve?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I remember shortly after my son died, it was one of the first days that I was home alone. My husband had gone back to work and my mom had left to go back home. And I remember sitting on the couch with my head in my hands and just thinking, I will never get through this. This feeling is so overwhelming and it's going to last forever. And through a lot of therapy and a lot of hard work and a lot of nurturing my grief, I am really proud to say that, you know, I have had a profound experience where I have come to realize that, you know, of course I'm going to grieve my son forever because I'm going to love him forever. And, you know, I really think that your grief is your love for your child who died. And because I'm going to love him forever, I'm going to grieve him forever. And one of the things I was saying to a friend not long ago is that from that moment on, I've really started to see my grief not as a weakness, but as a superpower. And you know, it is a very welcome part of my life now. I can't say that that makes everyone else in my life very comfortable. And yet, you know, that says more about them than it says about me. And you know, I don't have, of course, the relationship that I had expected to have with my son, who should be here and 3 years old and enjoying preschool. And, you know, I'm not able to have that relationship with him, but I do have a relationship with him, and it's beautiful.
We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about 100 years of insulin, actually talking about diabetes. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Today, we're talking about grief. Callie Hawkins is the interim executive director and director of programming at President Lincoln's Cottage in Washington, and she just shared her own grief journey that has given her insight into Mary Todd Lincoln's experience. And Julia Dunn, a licensed professional counselor and program director at Olivia's House, a grief and loss center for children. If you have a question or a comment, maybe your own story to tell, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Julia Dunn, Olivia's House is a grief and loss center for children, but I want to talk about grief overall for the most part. You heard Callie Hawkins' story, and you heard her tell the story of Mary Todd Lincoln. What are your thoughts on what you heard both from Callie and about Mrs. Lincoln?
Thank you, Scott. Well, Callie, I think it's so beautiful and important that you are able to have this conversation, and not only from a professional side of things, working at President Lincoln's College as the executive director, but also utilizing your own experience to connect with Mary's story and to bring this education to the forefront. And so much of what we talk about with Mary Lincoln is, you know, was her grief, was her version of mourning, quote, socially acceptable, you know, socially acceptable at the time, I believe was even a phrase that was used. And how do we change what is socially acceptable is we talk about these things that maybe feel a little yuckier or maybe don't feel like they always come to the surface. So Callie, kudos to you just for being so open to bring your child to the surface and use this as a lesson, because this is how we change what society sees as socially acceptable. And even to this day, Callie, you said it yourself, there is still a discomfort that comes when we share with others that we've had a loss, especially a loss of a child. So thinking back to where Mary Lincoln was at societally, culturally, in her own bereavement journey, she was not in a place where her bereavement was being supported. And that is such a crucial piece that was missing for her. When bereavement is supported, it allows you to move through all of the feelings and learning to cope and assimilate the loss into your life story. That all takes place when you have a strong safety net underneath you. When you have everyone coming at you, throwing accusations and trying to explain it away with mental illness diagnoses, you know, that's the opposite of support. If anything, that'll make a person really double down into that dark place where they're spiraling, because not only did she feel alone, but she's being told that she is very much alone in this experience. And even her own husband, very much able to throw himself into work, which really ties into what we see in the research of the difference between what we call male grief and female grief. And I know that that's, you know, gender is a much bigger discussion, but in the grief research, there's been this distinction. But again, not all men are male grievers and not all women are female grievers and vice versa. But male grief often looks like a person throwing themselves into work, moving forward, plowing ahead without even looking into their peripheral vision. Whereas female grief can look much more like going to a cottage, wanting to sit in silence. We call that turning inward and facing your pain. And that is what we saw so much with Mary. But because she was villainized and pathologized for doing what she needed to do to cope with all of these compounding losses, it was turned into this discussion of what's wrong with her versus how can we support her.
Mm-hmm. Julia, you know, something you just mentioned about men and women and how they grieve. I mean, isn't it true that one of the things that makes this so difficult for many people to understand or understand other people's grief is that everyone grieves differently? I mean, it's not like you can say, you know, here's someone who falls into this category, here's someone who falls into that category, that everyone feels differently, everyone bereaves differently, and that makes it difficult to, I don't know, maybe that makes it difficult, too, for someone to provide support because, well, let's face it, we're as Callie said, people are uncomfortable talking about death, and they're uncomfortable even talking to someone who has lost a loved one.
Absolutely. And there is, you're exactly right. And to think about this in another way as well, that Mary had these compounding losses. So, and I want to point out too, you know, grieving is, that's the feelings that we have on the inside. Those are grief. Mourning is grief gone public. Mourning is the way that grief looks on the outside. So if we're crying, if we're visiting a gravesite, if we're going to a cottage, if we're holding our husband, you know, those are all examples of mourning. And we all mourn losses in very different ways. Even if you lose three of your children, you have three very different relationships with each of your children. So the mourning is going to look different the same way that those relationships were different. And when you have these compounding losses, especially with the fact that her children were dying of illnesses, which adds that anticipatory grief on top of it. So that's the grief, the feelings that come as you're leading up to a potential death. That also brings all of that anxiety with it. You know, there were reports of Mary Lincoln pulling her hair out. That is a diagnosable disorder. That is called trichotillomania, and that is a common anxiety disorder. So it all, when you look at it from a mental health picture, everything that she did to mourn makes sense, especially, like you said, given the fact that people weren't open and willing to talk about it and bring that support and, you know, just flood her with love and saying, we're here for you. It was the exact opposite. It was the whispers and what's wrong with you. And then to add a whole other layer on this, when President Lincoln died, the entire country took on that loss as their own. So even with the loss of her husband, after tragically losing three of her children, even this loss didn't belong to her. And she wasn't allowed to privately mourn the way that would make sense to her. So that's another added piece that of sharing her grief, sharing her mourning, and not getting that support that she needed and deserved.
Julia, at Olivia's house, you're working mostly with children and grief. Do children grieve differently than adults, and in what ways?
It's a great question. So bereavement, the bereavement process that we go through, now again, just kind of differentiating these terms, the grief are the feelings that happen on the inside, mourning is grief gone public, and the bereavement process is the process that we go through learning to cope with a loss, and again, like I said, to assimilate that into our life story. So in that regard, our brains virtually do the same thing after a loss, whether you're 2 weeks old or 102 weeks old, you know, that our brains are designed to protect us when we've experienced a loss. And one of the very first things that our brain does when we have a loss, be it tragic and sudden or due to a long-term illness, there's a part of our brain that's called the amygdala, which is a small part of the brain. It's about the size of an almond, but it's very powerful. This is the part of the brain that controls our anxiety, our fight or flight, our reaction times. All of this is coming from this little almond-sized thing in our brain. When we have a loss, the amygdala virtually shuts off and stops connecting and communicating with the rest of the brain. So this is where we have this, what we call in the bereavement process, a period of shock and numbness. And when you think, look back to Mary Lincoln after a loss, that she didn't leave her bed for weeks. And again, this was pathologized. What's wrong with her? Is this her melancholy? That was her shock and numbness. That was her brain not reaching its full potential, which feels very odd for anyone who's experienced a loss. You know that those first couple days and weeks, you feel like the lights are on, but nobody's home. You're sort of just going through the motions, but you don't remember how you got from point A to point B. That is because of the brain shutting down to protect you. To do that so you don't have to deal with a rush of emotions all at once. And that's why we most likely saw Mary Lincoln not leaving her bed for weeks. But the brain powers back on. And again, this is the same for children and adults. And when the brain powers back on, it's almost like turning your phone on after having it off for a couple weeks or months. You would get a rush of notifications. That is sort of what's happening to your brain. You get all of these feelings and questions and emotions, and that's where we need to learn how to cope. And we can make the choice to cope positively. Again, being silent, turning inward, facing your grief, or you can cope negatively, which can be completely ignoring and avoiding your loss. It can be getting violent. It can be using substances to numb yourself back into that state of shock and numbness because the pain is too much. And again, when this isn't supported, and so much where Olivia's house can come in to educate families on how to provide that support, or, you know, give resources to become that safety net underneath them, you know, without that piece, it's very easy to slide into a negative coping skill. And in addition, I love, Callie, that you said this earlier too, that if Mary Lincoln had a mental illness of some sort, so what? That doesn't preclude her from feeling grief. That doesn't mean she doesn't deserve to be supported after the loss of three children and a husband. Who cares? That's like saying somebody with asthma, you know, doesn't deserve to grieve. It's all the same, mental illness, physical illness. They're just hitting different parts of the body. So I love that you said that, but I think that's another place where we see people pathologized and said, oh, there's Mary doing her Mary thing, versus saying, okay, this is Mary's unique experience and it may not look like mine, but how can we find a good way to support her?
If you have a question or comment, maybe a story to tell, you can give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalk@witf. Callie, from what you're hearing from Julia, did you experience those things?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and one of the things I was actually saying to a friend yesterday is specifically about how my husband and I have largely grieved very differently. It's been really interesting to kind of observe that. Yet, no matter how differently we've grieved, I know that he is the only other person on earth that has experienced the depth of this loss in remotely the same way as I have. And that's been a very connecting experience for us. And I think that you see that a lot too with the Lincolns. There was a real tenderness in their relationship too, even though they may have experienced the grief very differently. The other thing I'll say is that, you know, I was having my son around the time that a lot of my friends were also having children, and, you know, grief changes relationships. And, you know, I think one of the things, especially around the loss of a child, that is so hard for people is that, you know, maybe today, we think that doesn't happen anymore. or, you know, and I think that for so many people, when you know someone who loses a child, it's a reminder that it could happen to you too. And I think that, you know, that is something that I have experienced some in some personal relationships that's been really difficult to navigate. And, you know, my grief was largely in private, especially my early grief. And that's hard enough to have to grieve in public in the way that the Lincolns did. Really just, I think, should engender a lot of empathy from us today, and it really should have then.
You know,
and if I can chime in there,
go ahead, Julia. Yeah,
I wanted to say, I think it's so important, Callie, what you're sharing there. And I, you know, when I talk about finding meaning, assimilating the loss into who you are and into your life story, that is a taxing ask. So I don't ever mean to say that flippantly, but I can absolutely say that when a parent loses a child, going into that space, whether it's dark or whatever that looks like, and doing the sacred work of finding meaning from this loss takes a lot longer for those parents who have lost a child. And people do and will, and Callie, you've shared it very much yourself, that people will think you're crazy for not being over it. But if it's anything from, you know, this past Sunday was Mother's Day, and you remember that, you know, some people are getting two Mother's Day cards, you're getting one Mother's Day card. You know, you go shopping at the store and you walk through the Mother's Day aisle. That's a reminder. Every time your friends celebrate an achievement of their children, that's a reminder of your child. And that is something that you will never, quote, get over it. And that's where the societal conversation truly needs to change, is that until people are 90 years old, they will be able to do the math and say, my child would have been this old this year. This would have been their blank birthday. That never changes for a parent or a mother. And that's where I think people were so misguided in the past, thinking that, you know, because I'm over it, because it wasn't my child, you should be too. But bereavement is a lifelong process. There's no end game. There's no finish line. It's all about figuring out what this means for your life and how can I reconstruct my life to honor this loss and to honor this relationship. And Callie, you've just done an amazing job of showcasing that in your work today. So thank you again for sharing.
Thanks.
Just a couple personal thoughts here. You know, Julia, you just brought up Mother's Day. I lost my mother last year, and even though this was the second Mother's Day, I found myself depressed all day because it was Mother's Day and my mom wasn't here. That's one thing. The other thing is that the thought that crossed my mind is the comparison between Mary Todd Lincoln and Jacqueline Kennedy. Jacqueline Kennedy was, everyone said, oh, she was so stoic. She was so courageous at the days after President Kennedy was assassinated and at the funeral. You never saw her shed a tear. And, I look back on that today, you know, 60 years later, and I think to myself, why didn't she shed a tear in public? And I just kind of wonder about that. Just a couple of thoughts there. But, you know, yesterday I posted on social media about doing this program, and many of the comments that I heard, Julia, were from people saying, oh, I'm looking forward to this program because I've gone through the same thing where I've been grieving. I didn't get that support. But the big question they ask, and it almost sounded like they were looking for a silver bullet answer, is how do I get over it?
Mm-hmm. And that's it's a common question you hear, but I think Callie will back me up, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Callie, but there is no getting over it, because you will never get over the love of your child. That is not something to get over. And that is one thing you will never hear at Olivia's house, cross our lips, the words closure or acceptance. Even though those are words, and acceptance has been widely used in the dying community, not so much the death community, but you will never hear us say the word closure, because closure implies that you are closing a door on something, and you will never close the door on a loved one of any sort, but especially a child. That is something that a mother will never do, nor should she. And I think that is where we miss the mark a little bit, because we're looking, like I said, for this end goal, for the finish line of the sprint. But this is not a sprint. This is a marathon. And if anything, it's a marathon with no finish line. And our goal is right. to stay, you know, keep our strength up, keep going, take breaks when we need to, you know, go with that metaphor. But there is no getting over it. And Callie, I'd love to hear your thoughts too, that you would be hard pressed to ever think of trying to get over something. So please, what are your thoughts?
100%. And I, you know, very early on in my grief, I also really bristled at the sort of cards and the platitudes and all of that, that talked about, you know, this is a healing journey. And I remember like crying one evening to my husband and saying, but I don't want to heal from this. Like, this is not something that I want to heal from. I want to carry this scar forever because this is my child. And, you know, I think that it's, we have to stop approaching it like there is a finish line, because I think it sets up an unrealistic expectation for those who are trying to support grievers, as well as for grievers themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's really unfair. So I agree with you 100%, Julia.
Well, yeah.
I can just go off of that metaphor with the scar, just real quick. I think, you know, when we have a wound, if we think of a loss as a wound, you know, that wound will heal. It will not always be an open bleeding wound, but it will leave a scar, and that scar is with you forever. But where the differentiation comes in is we can let that wound get infected. We can ignore it. We can act like it's not there, and it'll probably be a lot worse for us. Or we can do the work of cleaning it out, making sure we care for it, that we're gentle, that we go easy on ourselves. And the scar is still going to be there, but it's not going to cause us as much pain as it would if we just ignored it and act like it wasn't there. So I love that you brought that metaphor, and I just wanted to tie that up together a little bit more too.
Well, Callie thank and Julia, I want to thank both of you for being on today's program. I mean, this is, I'm sure a lot of people maybe found some comfort. I don't know if that's the way to put it, but could probably relate. Many, many people could relate to the conversation that the two of you were having today. Callie Hawkins is the interim executive director and director of programming at President Lincoln's Cottage in Washington. I'll have to visit soon. Julia Dunn is a licensed professional counselor and program director at Olivia's House, a grief and loss center for children. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and it's, I will say, a difficult turn to talk about grief and death, to turn to any topic, but one that many Pennsylvanians have been wondering about here in the last few weeks. Many central Pennsylvanians will be traveling to the Jersey Shore for vacation this summer. New Jersey recently legalized marijuana for recreational purposes. So some vacationers are wondering if they can buy marijuana and partake while on vacation. Joining us is Melissa Chapaska. She is with Cannabis Law PA and the legal committee member of the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws Normal. Ms. Chapaska, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Okay, so here's the big question. I've actually heard people asking this question. Can they buy marijuana and smoke it while visiting New Jersey while on vacation?
At this time, no. While New Jersey did pass its law to decriminalize and create a legal recreational market, they actually haven't implemented that law yet. There is nowhere currently to legally purchase recreational marijuana in New Jersey. We're thinking 2022 at the earliest is when you'll see that. And addressing a neighboring state, New York is in a similar position. recently legalized recreational marijuana. However, legal sales aren't expected, at least for another year.
But when it does, this is implemented in both Jersey and New York, Pennsylvanians traveling to those states, are they just like any other consumer? Are they able to buy marijuana and partake?
They are just like any other consumer. So generally speaking, once those states have their adult use programs in place, what happens in Jersey stays in Jersey. You can purchase there. That said, a Pennsylvania resident visiting that's going to come back needs to be careful because there are some additional considerations on your return trip. It is still illegal here. Marijuana is still illegal here. So even if purchased legally in a state that has legal recreational marijuana, once you bring it back to Pennsylvania, it's illegal to possess again. And so you can get in trouble for that. Furthermore, crossing state lines, even crossing state lines between two states that have recreational marijuana, let's say between New York and New Jersey, federal law, marijuana is illegal under federal law, and federal law prohibits transporting marijuana across state lines. So that still is a federal crime to transport it.
And that the point you just brought up is what many of the states that have legalized marijuana now, we're up to, what, 14, I think? Or is it more than that?
There's a medical marijuana programs in, I believe it is 32 states
now. Right,
medical,
yeah.
Recreational. It's about 13.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought it was around a dozen or a little bit over a dozen. But that's what a point that many people bring up is that under federal law, it is still illegal, marijuana classified, as an illegal narcotic. And there's a word you don't hear very often anymore, but classified as an illegal narcotic. I mean, is there the possibility that in a state where it has been legalized by the state legislature, signed by the governor, that a Pennsylvanian could be arrested or charged with possession? Now, obviously, it can't happen in Jersey, but I don't know. Where does the federal law come in here?
Right. So while the federal law is expansive, right, the federal law kind of is underlying all of this. You know, it really comes down to enforcement and whether the DEA is, you know, sitting at the border between two neighboring states that have legal marijuana waiting to catch people. And I think as a practical matter, that isn't the case. Furthermore, the DOJ, the Department of Justice will not go into states with state legal marijuana as long as you're in a state following those state laws. There is some federal protection in the form just of enforcement priorities from the DOJ.
Do you think that the federal law will change? I mean, under the Trump administration, the Department of Justice, if anything, wanted to expand or crack down on states that legalize marijuana for recreational purposes. The Biden administration has talked about it a little bit, at least publicly from what I hear. But do you think the federal government will make a change?
You know, I'm not a fortune teller, but I think that if you look at the current status of things and where things are going, particularly with more and more states getting on board with legalization, I think that that's really going to inspire the federal government to have to do something to address this market. Because as a result of the federal law, you know, we run into these conundrums like with travel between states, banking, right? So something Pennsylvania purchasers should know is that when going into these states to buy marijuana, bring cash. They're primarily cash only business as a result of federal banking and other restrictions on marijuana businesses.
You talked about traveling over state lines. The comparison that some people could make is that it is illegal now to buy alcohol in another state and bring it into Pennsylvania. Now, the difference is that's for tax purposes. Pennsylvania wants to make sure they get their tax money. But at the same time, it's not a federal law. And from what I understand, that's not a law that is enforced very often. What would the, if you bought marijuana in Jersey and brought it back into Pennsylvania, any idea what kind of crime you would be looking at and, possible criminal sanctions?
Right. So that interstate transportation, and that's going to be really dependent on how much you've brought over, whether you're in possession of a small amount or a large amount, and who you're dealing with, right? Because it's going to be very discretionary on whether they'll enforce it and whether they'll prosecute. So that said, there are criminal penalties involved with that. So it's definitely a possibility that you'll get hit with some criminal penalties there.
Mm-hmm. I know I'm jumping around on you here with a lot of different questions, but going back to Jersey, as you mentioned, New Jersey is still implementing this law. From what I understand, many of the towns in New Jersey, including those along the shore, are opting out of allowing the dispensaries in those towns. I mean, Atlantic City is an exception. There will be dispensaries in Atlantic City. I think there's some in the northern shore towns too, but Ocean City, even Wildwood is a town that has decided not to allow it. And there even are some that are saying are creating laws that you're not allowed to smoke it in public, even though, from what I understand, the New Jersey law says towns can't do that. They're doing it anyway. So it sounds as if many of these places are sitting back to see what's happening. Would you agree with that?
Yes. And, by virtue of these laws, both in New York and New Jersey's recreational laws, municipalities, localities are allowed to prohibit or restrict recreational marijuana in their areas. And that may just be a wait and see thing. And as you mentioned, the bigger cities, New York City is another one where it's not likely we're going to see them prohibiting dispensaries from being in New York City. And as there's a separate question within there about public use. So actually under New Jersey's law, recreational marijuana is limited to use in private residence. This is the same with DC. DC is a little unique and I won't get into it, but you can only use in a private residence, or in the case of New Jersey, they do plan on permitting cannabis consumption areas where one will be allowed to use. But you're not going to see people smoking on the Jersey Shore.
Now, for New York,
you might see it someplace. So New York's law is actually one of the first that prohibit or that allows for smoking marijuana anywhere tobacco products are allowed. So New York's a little different and does allow for some public use.
We only have a couple of minutes left. Pennsylvania is there is a move here in Pennsylvania to legalize marijuana for recreational purposes. What can Pennsylvania learn from the surrounding states? I mean, often in the past, states that are considering legalization have looked to Colorado or looked to Washington State, two of the early states for legalization. But what can Pennsylvania learn from the surrounding states?
That is a wonderful question, a lot. As you said, states tend to look to states in the West, Colorado, Washington. But the benefit of being able to look at New Jersey, New York, is that we're able to see how their cultivation works. Whereas in California, you can grow outdoors, or it's a lot easier to grow outdoors. We have different environmental concerns and things in Pennsylvania with actually producing cannabis. So we can learn there. Not to mention, we can also learn from these programs. What's a really great thing that's coming from these legalizations in these states is that a lot of the money coming in from sales is being used to fund community programs. So, for instance, in New York, money will go towards the Drug Treatment and Public Education Fund. And so that's a really great use of that money, and something that I think Pennsylvania can really take a hard look at and think about implementing here.
Melissa Chapaska is with Cannabis Law PA and a legal committee member of the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws. We may be speaking again in the future. I have a feeling we will. Melissa, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Have a great morning.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.